You are the last few verses of James chapter 3. Thank you, folks, for handing those out. We will put this outline also up on the website, since we have so many people that listen. I know I said this every week in James, but it's practically true every week. The passage we're looking at tonight is very significant to me. It is transforming to me. I typed up this little thing to help put it in an orderly way because it's just a little bit convoluted the way it's laid out in the text. Pastor Chuck called this the litmus list. Any of you remember high school chemistry? I know you guys are trying to forget over there. Remember what litmus paper is? They give you a row of beakers filled with different colors of liquid, and then they would give you these little strips of paper, and you would dip the paper in each liquid, a strip of paper, and if it was an acid base, if it was acid, it would turn one color. If it was basic, it would turn another color, and it was kind of it's kind of cool actually, because of course, that was the test. You know, here's these unlabeled mysterious liquids, and you could at least start nailing down what they were based on the litmus test. And Pastor Chuck used that phrase, and it stuck in my head when I first started going to a church that actually studied the Bible. After being raised in a certain denomination filled with very dogmatic, very forceful preaching, where you were not allowed to ask questions, where you had to accept whatever was told to you. And I started going to a church where we studied the Bible, and I was blown away how much stuff I had heard growing up that was really contrary to what the Bible taught. It really blew me away. I guess I was very naive. And I thought, well, how can those people teach that when it's right here? And then I started discovering that the way that they were teaching it and their whole posture and leadership was completely different, not only from Jesus, but it was different from clear instruction in Scripture. And that was a real revelation to me that a lot of people, their idea of what is godly wisdom has to do with who's yelling the loudest or who's the most forceful. Or there's an odd thing, because for some people, the more affluent the ministry is, the more they think it must be of God. But then there's the polar extreme opposite. There are some people who are so afraid of affluence that the more poverty-stricken it looks, then the more they think, well, they must be really spiritual. How are we to know? How are we to know in the midst of a world where there are so many radio and TV programs and piles of books and huge churches? How are we supposed to know what godly wisdom looks like? Right here in this passage is one of just the clearest little laid out things I have ever seen. It has helped me personally. I made a list in my Bible, in the very first Bible that I had when I started going to Calvary Chapel. And the reason that I typed this out for you is you might want to hang on to this. I test every counselor that I go to with this list. Every person that gets all excited about some new ministry or some new author, I run it through this list. I myself am subject to this list. If I claim that I'm offering godly wisdom, of course, the closer you stay to the Bible, the safer you are, right? But you got to know a lot of the Bible sometimes to know some of the weird stuff. So this is a great, great list. I wish I hadn't had to separate it from last week, because they're connected. They're part of the same thought. And so to really do it justice, I need to give a little bit of a recap of what James talked about last week about the power of our words to influence and to destroy even. And he starts out by saying, you know, he says it'd be a good policy for you to not presume to be a what the Amplified Bible calls a self-constituted reprover or corrector of others. Putting yourself in a place of instruction. He said, just you might not want to go there, because we who are instructors, James including himself, even though he wasn't self-constituted, he was called by God. But he says, those that are in a place of instruction, instructing others, will be judged more strictly. And then he says, and you know what? We all make mistakes. So if you can avoid being in that target zone, probably a good idea. And then he goes off from there to talk about the power of our words. He uses the example of putting a bridle in a horse's mouth. You want to turn that big, powerful animal, pull on the reins, and he'll go wherever you want him to go. And we talked last week that the reason that for that is pain. And the fact that James uses that in conjunction with learning to control our own words, I have to tell you from personal sad experience that that's the way I have learned to control my words more than any other way, is pain. Pain that I've caused to other people, things that I've said, I would give anything if I could unsay them, which of course you can't. And then James, we refer back to chapter 1, verse 26, where he said, if you consider yourself to be religious, but you don't have a tight rein on your tongue, he says, that's worthless religion. All the bells and smells, all of the things you do and the things you don't do, and all of the little ceremonies you go through, and all of your religious posture, he says, it's pointless if it can't enable you to control the one thing that does the most damage to other people. And then he begins to talk about briefly several, I think, excellent examples, pictures of the devastation that our words can cause. And probably the most poignant one is the one that one spark, all it takes is one spark to set a whole forest on fire. And he said, and your tongue is a fire. That's sobering, isn't it? And then the last part of that sentence is the one that always gets me. This is the one that makes me gulp the most. He said, your tongue is set on fire by hell itself, which speaks of deliberate, intentional arson on the part of Satan. Satan wants to start fires, and he wants to use our words to do it. And oh, he's good at it, isn't he? And this is the part that just fills me with chagrin, when I realize that I have played right into his hand. In a moment of anger or selfishness or judgmentalism, you know, you walk away from this big pile of bodies that are, you just slayed with your words and walk away. And then all of a sudden you see Satan giving you a standing ovation because you just saved him a lot of trouble, because you wiped out all those Christians with your words. And it's sobering, and it's meant to be. It's meant to be one of those kind of things. Now, why would God use these kind of strong terms? Well, he's trying to protect us. He's trying to protect us from that, starting that forest fire that you can't undo. James wrote this when he was pretty old. It's written to the church. And the passage that we're going to look at tonight, about at the end of this chapter, about learning to recognize fleshly wisdom from godly wisdom, which obviously the church needs. I find it kind of disheartening that all of these problems were something James was addressing 2,000 years ago, and for the most part, haven't gotten any better. We still need the same warnings. We still need the same examples. I love that God is blunt with us, if that's what it takes. He says it very clearly, and I love James for that. He said, you know, out of one side of our mouths, we bless God, which is the kissy face word. It's the, oh God, you're just so sweet, you're so wonderful, and oh, I love you, and please bless me, and, you know, that kissy face thing. And they said, with the same mouth, we curse people that he loves, that are being made into his very image. And he said, blessing and cursing out of the same mouth, he says, that's not right. That word cursing, I told you last week, it doesn't mean profanity. That would be easy to get you off the hook. You could just say, well, don't cuss, and then you'll be okay. No, it's the word simply, in its simplest terms, means a put down. The broadest extent of this word katara, that's translated cursing, is to anything that you say that hurts people. So, sobering words. And now, with all of that in mind, now he talks about two kinds of wisdom, two basic categories of wisdom. That which is godly and that which is not. I'm going to read through it. I laid it out in a more of a systematic way. It's a little bit convoluted. Like I said, he doesn't do it in the same order that I do, but I wrote down the verses so that you could check me out, make sure I'm not making this up. But let's open our hearts to this. I found this to be so illuminating. It was so clear to me. I've used it on myself, like I said. I've used it when somebody comes along and says, brother, you need some instruction, and God told me to tell you, and I listen to what they say, and then I would go and grab my little list, and I'd check it out and say, okay, does this smell like Jesus? Does this sound like godly wisdom, or doesn't it? And I hope that it will be as helpful to you as it has been to me. The first words of verse 13 are what I used to call sarcasm until Nancy told me the correct definition of sarcasm. They're ironic. They're sort of tongue-in-cheek. They're just a little bit facetious. You get the feeling that being around the church, James, first of all, ran into people like up in verse 1 who felt that it was their personal mission to straighten other people out. Those kind of people are still around. I have to admit, I used to be one before the grace of God changed that. But you get the feeling that he's used to people waltzing in and claiming that they're wise and understanding. So listen to what he says. Who is wise and understanding? Should be little facetious quote marks around that, I think. Who is wise and understanding among you? Well, let him show it by his good life. Underline that word, that phrase, good life. We're going to go at this in great detail tonight. By deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. The Amplified Bible says from true wisdom. Does that sound weird? Humility and wisdom in the same sentence? In our culture, it almost sounds wrong, but it is true biblical wisdom contains the component of humility. But if you harbor bitter envy or bitterness and envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't brag about it, don't boast about it, or deny the truth. The NIV is, I think, a little bit weak. It literally means be false to the truth, but or be pretending to be something that you're not. Such wisdom, and the Amplified Bible says such superficial wisdom, I like that, does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual. If you have a King James Bible, it says sensual, but that's a 1611 English word that's changed its meaning a little bit. Unspiritual or fleshly would be better. So it's earthly, fleshly, of the devil. Because where you have envy and selfish ambition, you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom which comes from heaven, godly wisdom, is first of all pure, then peaceable or peace-loving, gentle. The NIV says considerate, but mostly this Greek word is translated gentle. It is my favorite Greek word this week. Gentle, submissive, full of mercy, full of good fruit, impartial, and that word should be circled. That's a weak translation of the Greek word. It literally means you don't need an opinion poll to make a decision. It means you're certain without hesitancy. You're not waiting to see which way the wind blows. And impartial is just a little bit weak. And sincere or unhypocritical. The NIV, I think, does the best job of verse 18, although it is a little bit convoluted in the other translations, but I like the way the NIV renders it. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. So there's just a few verses, five verses? But there's just a wealth of fabulous instruction in here. And like I said, I take this very seriously myself. It applies to me. It applies to anybody who claims that they're going to speak God's wisdom. Here's the good thing. As I said before, the more that you know God's word, the more that you know Jesus and his heart and his ways, the easier it is to tell those who are properly representing him from those who are not. But that takes time. The thing that I love about this one little passage in James, it's like litmus paper. You know, you just stick the little two lists in there, and some stuff you can see right away. There, your little caution light goes off and said, you know, this does not smell like godly wisdom at all. Or it does, even if it's something that you don't want to hear. So let's examine this. We'll look at it. Julia suggested last night up in Rockland that she would feel better if I did the icky list first and then the good list last. And I don't want to minimize that, but if it's too late, I already typed out my little outline. So we'll just, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the first sentence gives us the first qualities of godly wisdom. And then you jump down to verse 17 for the rest of it. And then we'll come back and we'll look at the verses in between that talk about worldly wisdom. First thing probably, and I put it on your little handout sheet, it's good to have a definition of wisdom. The best grab handle, easy to hang on to, definition that I've ever heard is that wisdom, differing from intelligence, differing from knowledge, they're not synonymous with each other. We all know people who are very intelligent and have no wisdom. We know people who have lots of knowledge and have no wisdom. Wisdom, by definition, is the proper and appropriate application of knowledge. And of course, that's going to look different depending on your value system, isn't it? I know some very intelligent people in the Northwest. I lived on an island with them, who are absolutely fanatical about environmentalism, animal rights. They helped to push through legislation that made it a misdemeanor. You could go to jail for touching an eagle's egg when bald eagles were an endangered species. They were very persistent. They had all kinds of statistics at their behest. These same people were pro-abortion. And these same people tried to push through legislation to make it illegal to block the entrance of an abortion clinic. So you have intelligent people who are saying it should be against the law to touch an unborn eagle, but it's okay to kill unborn humans. And you should go to jail if you try to prevent someone from killing an unborn human. Does that make sense? These are not dumb people. These are very intelligent people. Do they have wisdom? From their point of view, they do. But see, their value system is completely different than God's. So their connection of the dots looks way different than yours or mine if we are trying to find the appropriate application of knowledge based on what God says. So, and the only reason I said that is the world is filled with this. It's all around us. The Bible said in the last days, wrong was going to be considered right, and right was going to be considered wrong by most people. It's very confusing. James wrote this to Christians, that's us, to church people. So obviously, we're coming from the posture that the appropriate and proper application of knowledge has to line up with God's character and with God's word. And so James says, you want to walk into our assembly and tell us how wise and understanding you are? Oh, you who want to instruct everyone? James says, okay, then you should be able to demonstrate that you have godly wisdom by the way that you live your life, which is what verse 13 is saying. Who is wise and understanding among you? Well, let him show it. I looked that word up. I thought it might mean demonstrate, but it does not. The Greek word means show evidence of it. Don't just tell me how wise and understanding you are. It should show up in the way you live your life. I have one little rabbit trail tonight just because one of my very favorite Greek words, and it every week except this week, it usually is my favorite Greek word, but now epiekkes is my favorite Greek word. It's the word kalos, K-A-L-O-S, and it's translated good in verse 13, which says, let him show it by his good life. If you have an old King James Bible, it probably says good conversation. If you have a new King James Bible, they corrected that because the word conversation in 1611 meant something completely different than it does today. And so the New King James says your good conduct or your good behavior, because the Greek word simply means behavior or the way that you live your life. And so the NIV correctly translates that good life. My one beef with this is the word good is extremely watered down. So I'm going to do a little brief rabbit trail about what the word kalos means. It's a fat, fat word. If you look in an expository dictionary, a dictionary where they spend a lot of time and don't just give you short little definitions, most of the really good guys will devote an entire page to this word, to this adjective. It's a fat word. Some of the synonyms, some of the phrases that are synonyms are beautiful. That's the one most commonly used. Or wonderful. It means, we talked about this, Sandra, I remember you making a comment about this when I taught this 5 or 6 years ago, because it's a word of artistry. It means well-proportioned in all aspects, perfectly functional, excellent in its artistry. All of that is wrapped up in this word, kalos. So can you see, to just translate that, the English word, good, that's just, that should be against the law. That just really waters the word down. It's a word that appears in some really important scriptures. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says that God makes everything kalos in his time. I know it's Hebrew, but in the Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, the word that's translated beautiful in our English Bibles is this word kalos. God makes everything kalos in his time or in the time he has set for it. And then in Mark 7, it says about Jesus, everything Jesus does is kalos. I just love that. In the English Bible, it says everything Jesus does is wonderful. But again, that's just watered down. Let me just give you the best example I know of the word kalos. This is my rabbit trail. I have a friend. I don't know where he lives now because I haven't seen him for years, but he used to live in Gold Beach, Oregon. And he made wood chisels. a set of his wood chisels and gouges sold for thousands of dollars. They were made out of steel that he got from ancient sawmills in the redwood country, old steel, back when they made really good steel. His chisels would hold an edge forever. You could shave with them. You could hold up one of his gouges that were 16 inches long, and you could hold it on your finger, and it was perfectly balanced. He carved the handles out of exotic woods that he matched, the whole set, got them from all over the world, and he carved the handles for the hands of the people who ordered a set of his chisels. And for those that just wanted to come in and buy a pair that were already made, he had left-handed chisels and gouges and right-handed chisels and gouges. They came in a beautiful myrtlewood case set in velvet. One set that I saw cost $9,000. He already had two more of them that have been ordered. He said, you want to know what ticks me off? He said, what ticks me off is the rich guys from California that come in here, buy my chisels, make a little Lexan case for them, and put them with a little spotlight on them in their den. He said, that ticks me off. He says, these do not cost $9,000 because they're beautiful. They cost $9,000 because they're beautiful, and you can use this chisel every day for the rest of your life. And it'll still be beautiful. It'll still be perfect. It won't break. It'll still be balanced. It's the easiest steel in the world, put it in. And he went on and on and on. I thought, whoa, this guy's very intense. You know, he had so many orders, he couldn't keep up with them from people who understood the value of that. That is the perfect definition of kalos.